Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and of course bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests. And, well, right now, of course, we have on the line with us Melody Cederstrom from Discount Gold and Silver, and Melody does support Radio Liberty, and we appreciate that very much. And we're going to be talking about what's really going on with the economy. Now, most people know that something is happening, but we keep being reassured by the government that really things are not that bad at all. We may have lost 4,000 jobs last month, and of course the jobs that were actually constructed there, that were actually produced, were, they were certainly in rather menial tasks. 24,000 of them certainly were in jobs as waitresses and bartenders, and the government sector lost 28,000 jobs, and the private sector accumulated 24,000 jobs, but none of them were in manufacturing, and overall the loss was 4,000 jobs. If you look and see what's happening, the government tells us that inflation is 2%, maybe, if you don't use the core inflation, when you take in food and fuel, it's up to 4%. But the truth of the matter is, they're simply lying to the American people. Inflation rates running about 11%. Wheat hit over $8 a bushel this last week. Futures on oil closed at over $80 a barrel. And they know what's going on. They just don't want you to know. Our friends who are calculating the M3, that is the figures that the government doesn't want you to know and no longer actually publishes. Our friend Bob Chapman says M3 is running at over 14% at the present time, which means, of course, we're on the brink of runaway inflation. The Federal Open Market Committee is going to meet next Tuesday, I believe it is, and decide whether or not to lower interest rates to try to get the economy going. And they're talking a quarter, half a percent, lowering the discount rate. But if they lower that, why, of course, it's really going to promote inflation. If they don't do something, why, the whole economy is going to collapse. If they raise it, why, of course, is what they should do, why the economy would fall apart. And, of course, what you're seeing all across the country is the number of foreclosures on homes is increasing dramatically. We're finding fewer and fewer people are buying homes now. The home construction market is just falling apart. The brokerage and banking interests are laying off large numbers of people. Hedge funds are beginning to lose money. Of course, last year, some of the hedge funds managers made between $500 million and $1 billion a year because they were making so much money, but those days seem to be gone forever. Melody, how do things look from where you are?
Fairly gloomy, as you just stated, and you did pointed out some very significant areas, and everyone is eyeing the Feds for next week to see what Bernanke will do. And it really does, I don't believe it matters which way he does, whether he'll cut rates to keep the economy going, keep them the same, or raise them. I think either way, it doesn't change anything.
It's a lose-lose situation,
yes.
Because, of course, there's no instance in all history where a fiat money system has survived. And just between you and me, I don't think they want it to survive. If they can destroy our economy, they can bring about a global currency and a global government and a new world religion. Well, Melody, certainly gold seems to be doing fairly well. What happened to the dollar the last couple of days? It broke below, actually, 80. Has it stayed below, or has it gone back up again?
No, it actually closed below 80 several days, and it looked like it was about ready to breach 79 today, and it came back up a little bit. It showed they were able to manage it to give it a little bit of strength. And currently, right now, we see the dollar about 79.39.
All right. So, now, could you explain to our listeners why this is important? After all, we're not involved. The average person isn't involved in international finance. So, what does it matter if the dollar is falling in relationship to other currencies? How does that affect you and me?
Well, that's a big question. Well, it affects us because we have a dollar that is the world's reserve currency. And we have, and it's the value of the dollar that decreases. We see rising prices, which is the indicator of inflation. So as the dollar lowers, everything gets higher. So we talk about inflation and we talk about higher prices, but what it really means is that the U.S. dollar is losing its value, and it takes more of those dollars in which to buy the things that we purchase. So it basically strips everyone of their purchasing power, and people look at it as inflation as a tax, but it is truly a government controlled. Our inflation is controlled by the government. It is created by the government. And again, this is what we received from the fiat currency that we have.
And I think, Chris, one of the most significant things, is, as Melody said, is that the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. People throughout the world have always invested in dollars because they were stable. It was certainly one of the most stable of the currencies, and we have about $4 trillion of debt that can be bought up. Actually, a lot of this, of course, is money that's owed because of the money stolen from Medicare and Social Security pension funds. But there's a little over $4 trillion, which has to be publicly financed, and about half of that is financed by foreigners. So they're holding American debt in dollars, but the value of the dollar is falling. So if they own, let's say, $100 billion, and the dollar loses a couple of percent of its value, or they lose a couple of percent of their $100 billion. And pretty soon, foreign countries don't want to be holding a debt that's going down in value. This is the big problem. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're just talking about the fact the value of the dollar is falling. Certainly, within the last few weeks, foreign central banks have disposed of about $42 billion of their holdings. In other words, foreign central banks and foreigners are beginning to dump their dollars. And those dollars are then going to have to be either purchased by the Federal Reserve System, monetized, which is highly inflationary, or the whole system begins to fall apart. And what happens when people in other countries begin losing confidence in your currency because its value is falling? They want to get out of that currency. And, of course, as they do, they dump their dollars. And all those dollars that we've been exporting to other countries begin flooding back in here. We've been exporting our inflation, for the better part of 30 or 40 years. Those dollars come home to roost, and people are going to find out the value of everything that they've worked their whole life for can simply evaporate within a matter of just a few months. Go right ahead, Melody.
Six out of the last 7 weeks, there has been a reduction in foreign central bank holdings of our dollar. And the report that I received this information stated that this has not occurred since going back as far as 2002, and that was the year in which the data had begun to be collected. And so they don't want to, these foreign central banks, they certainly don't want to be stuck, so to speak, with a currency that is plummeting. So and we have to ask ourselves, who's going to take their place once they begin to if they continue, which I think they will continue to unload the dollar, who will step in and take their place? Well, the only one there able to pick up the pace will be the Federal Reserve. And again, so now we're looking at even more money being monetized, and again, just additional measures to which hyperinflation will continue to plague us. So it's they're going to continue to throw money at the problem and at the system before they decide to correct any of the problems. And I'm not sure there is a way to fix the problem except to let this unfold, let the systems purge, and perhaps start from scratch.
Well, I think
again, you can always, you know, go back to the biggest problems that we've always had, and that was they need to put tariffs and taxes and everything else and everything, but, you know, that's part of the way to fix the problems, but it won't fix the monetary crisis that we're having.
And I really think it's really very interesting, because what we've seen recently, you know, is actually gold going up, and gold's gone up from about 660 here just a few weeks ago up to about 710. I don't know where it closed today, but where did gold close today?
709.90, 710.
So basically gold is up about $50 an ounce. And now you're really talking, gold is up about 7 or 8% in the last few weeks. People don't understand what that means. That means that people throughout the world know that the dollar is falling, that no inflation is taking hold, and they want to get into something safe. And a lot of people have been getting into treasury bills because that was supposedly safe, and yet suddenly people, at least some of the big smart people, the hedge fund managers, the pension fund managers, the banks are beginning to get out of the treasury bills and get into something that's going to hold its value. Not simply it's going to lose value as treasury bills can. So, Cindy, are you seeing much response to this from your buyers out there in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. And since the beginning of August, we were sort of in the summer doldrums, and when we saw the market correct at those close to 1,000 points in the beginning of August, it certainly woke a lot of people up. There was an urgency and concern about their losing their funds in a market like that. Things have sort of calmed down. I don't see the urgency so much, because you look at the Dow, and that is an indicator. You know, they get fooled. You know, I've always mentioned that the world could be falling apart and people would run to see what the Dow Jones is doing. It gives them a comfort, and it's the opposite of what gold is. We look at gold and we see the problems as gold rises. People look at the Dow and see comfort, thinking that everything is okay as long as they see the Dow still at those levels. So business is still brisk and people are still concerned, and they're readjusting their cash that they're holding, but certainly not the urgency that we saw at the same time the market was falling. And what's interesting is, according to, there's a popular website, it is Kitco, and they post London PM6s for gold, and they go back a very long time. And if you go back to January of 1980, they had gold closed in a consecutive fashion over $700. Well, if we close above $700 tomorrow, we will have... it will sort of be a gold historic day, and perhaps it would likely set the precedent of gold prices, creating a new base at 700. So something interesting to look at the price of gold and some historical comparisons back to 1980 when we saw it go to 850.
And I think that certainly we're going to see this again. Remember, Chris, what you're really seeing is not that gold is going up in price or in value. It is simply that the dollar, which is the medium of our exchange, is losing value, and this is the tragic thing. And everybody then who has their investments in dollar-denominated vehicles is losing. And, of course, the stock market is totally manipulated by the Working Group on Financial Matters. It's a government agency. The whole idea is a matter of perception. I mean, people, as Melody said, they look at the Dow Jones and they say, well, the Dow Jones is doing right. Things must be all right. And, of course, if you and I went out to manipulate the stock market, they'd put us in prison. The government does this with impunity because it's perfectly legal. Executive order was passed during the Reagan administration that allowed the manipulation of the stock market by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department and working in conjunction with certain banking interests and with certain large stockbrokers. And when the market starts to fall, in fact, what, one day here, a couple of weeks ago, I mean, it started out strong, then it fell, and I think it was down 300 and some odd points, and then just in the last very few minutes of the day, suddenly all these orders came in from the Cayman Islands and ran it back up. So I think I forgot whether it closed a few dollars behind or a few dollars ahead, but it's obviously manipulation. That's how they keep the people happy and dumb and waiting for the slaughter, like the animals in the stockyard. You never want them to know what lies ahead. And that's what they do. They manipulate our reality. They create our concepts. And most people have no idea we're being manipulated by an invisible hand out there. Edward Bernays wrote about that in 1928, the book called Propaganda, and I see this happening right today with the manipulation of the stock market. Our economy is in real trouble. Our industries are being sent overseas. The wage level of many Americans is falling dramatically. We have an increasing number of people who have accumulated great wealth in this fiat money system, investing in hedge funds. Can you imagine investing in a hedge fund where the hedge fund manager was making $500 or $600 million a year, and some of them making over $1 billion a year because that hedge fund was making so much money in the carry trade and derivatives and all sorts of leveraged things. And but those days are about over, don't you think, Melody?
Well, I agree. I mean, you know, things have gotten so big, it's like, you know, when you create digits out of thin air, when you create money out of thin air, I mean, there is absolutely no reality to anything anymore. And it goes back so many years, and so many people like to blame this administration, and it goes back so many years because it isn't an agenda. It is the promotion of a one-world government and currency and religion. And it started a long time ago. And, you know, we often look at the 1950s as perhaps the ideal time in which to... You know, it seemed like everything, it was the perfect little world. But yet to me, that was almost the beginning of their little illusion creation because, you know, there is no such thing as the 50s, really. But it gave people something. It created the American dream out of the 50s. And so it goes back so many years. I mean, sure, we can even go back hundreds of years if you want. But if we look back at... to our generation, and it is truly mind-boggling, and I can in a way understand why people have such a hard time grasping what is actually happening. And but you would think as the dollar purchases less and less and the dollar gets weaker and weaker, and these people are getting, I mean, they have no more pride in the jobs in which they work, you know, getting, you know, $7 an hour from when they once were making $20 an hour. I can understand why they're in denial and they don't want to face reality, but it certainly is a disturbing.
And, of course, a lot of people have lost their good-paying jobs and they're having to take a couple of jobs now just to keep going. And of course, if they've got large house payments, more and more of them are not able to keep up with those large house payments. And even a lot of good people with very, very good credit ratings are going to end up losing their homes.
Yep.
And the number of foreclosures is increasing all across America. We're going to be back here and welcome your calls. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Well, Melody, certainly as we look and see what's happening, why the price of gold, silver going up, but whether this actually reflects increase in...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
And why you're going to be talking 6.5% or 7.5%. Some of the refinancing and mortgages are even going up to as high as 8%. And of course, when you have a job that's not paying that much money, there's no way in the world that you're going to be able to make those mortgage payments, and you're going to lose your home. And that home's going to go into foreclosure. And, of course, this is happening to tens of thousands of homes and probably will end up happening to millions of homes. And, of course, why that is important is because many of our large financial institutions, our banks, our hedge funds, our pension funds, and maybe your pensions, are invested in these collateralized debt obligations. They call them CDOs. And basically, they're bonds that people, financial institutions, bought those bonds with the idea that they were going to get a certain fixed rate of interest on them. And suddenly they find out that these bonds that they paid 100 cents on the dollar on are really only worth 75 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, 25 cents on the dollar. And when they try to sell them, somebody says, sure, I'll buy them 25 cents on the dollar. What do you do when you're a pension fund and you've got a lot of money invested in something and you've lost 75% of your investment? You certainly don't want to let anybody know that. Or if you're a hedge fund manager, and many of the hedge funds, these highly leveraged financial organizations, you know, that have been making 40, 50, 60% profit every year, now have bought up a lot of these CDOs, these collateralized debt obligations, and they're not going to be able to get their money out of them. And then what about the people who are in derivatives, who guaranteed the loans from the pension funds, who guaranteed the loans from the on the hedge funds and the banks and the other institutions that have bought up these collateralized debt obligations that aren't worth hardly the paper they're written on? Then what happens to them? Because the derivatives, of course, they have to make good in case, you know, the bonds don't turn out to be good. And of course, these hedge funds are leveraged, but derivatives are amazing amounts of leverage. And certainly there are banks like, J.P. Morgan Chase and the Bank of America here have this large part of the derivatives of the world. And if those things start to go down, so will those banks, I fear. Go ahead, Melody. What are your thoughts? And incidentally, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to enter into our conversation. But I think we're on the edge of a financial abyss. I believe that we're seeing a financial tsunami that's going to sweep across this nation and change the financial landscape forevermore. Go right ahead.
Well, I agree, and there's a lot of chatter that, the worst is over, and, there's going to be homeowners that lose their homes, or, they'll be paying higher rates, but I do not believe it's over. We have a long way to go as yet. It could be another, two, 3 years before we're through feeling the effects of this financial problem that we have in the housing and the financial markets. So we have a long way to go, and even though there seems to be, when you look at everything, it's like they can calm one area, but then you look at where the dollar is at again, you see the dollar losing value. So it's like everything is just coming together to have that financial tsunami that you mentioned. And people do need to be protect and buy the insurance for the unknown, for the uncertainty that we face as these things unfold, and as we see, continuing, as you mentioned earlier, higher oil prices and higher food prices. I think not only will we have higher food prices, I believe there's going to be shortages next year. It looks like 2008 is going to be more troubling than what 2007 has been. And I don't know if Dr. Stan is there or not.
Oh, yeah, Dr. Stan is here.
Are we on break? Or?
No, we're going to a break very shortly.
Oh, okay.
But I think the thing is that people have got to get out of debt. They have to actually get out of any risky investments and just be prepared to weather the storm. And I believe that there are going to be food shortages. I think there's going to be civilian unrest in this country. And that is why, of course, they are setting up concentration camps all across America. People say it couldn't be true, but it is. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Melody Cedarstrom, and we're talking about what is going to be happening as far as our financial institutions are concerned. And of course, the thing is that some of our corporations are making pretty good income, but they're not making it here in the United States. They're making it certainly over in China or wherever they're set up, because they've transferred their manufacturing to other countries. And then, of course, they're shipping the goods back in here with the idea of selling them in the United States. But the trouble is, as more and more Americans lose their jobs, as more and more Americans certainly have to take lower-paying jobs, as so many people today are trying to preserve their living standards simply on credit cards. There's over $2.5 trillion in credit card debt out there. But of course, that's trouble with credit card debt, is sometimes you've got to pay it back. And if you don't, a lot of the credit card companies are raising their interest rate. And the longer you wait, the more you're going to pay. And pretty soon, you're only going to be able to afford to pay the interest on your credit card, nothing on the principal. And unfortunately, increasingly, you can't get rid of your debt by going bankrupt. You used to be able to, but this everything is calculated very, very carefully. They knew exactly what was going to happen, and so several years ago they changed the bankruptcy laws so that, you know, you couldn't simply go bankrupt and walk away from your debt. When that happened, Melody, did you realize, of course, that they were looking ahead, knowing full well what was going to happen?
Absolutely. All the laws, all the regulations, all the rules is designed for them, to protect them and their wealth. They don't care about people. They don't care about you. They don't care about anybody. It's all about their wealth, and everything is designed for them. And the system is for them, and it's not for us. They will continue to get wealthy and more powerful. And a few people might win, but the majority of people will lose. And if you think that you can gamble and be part of their game and be part of their system, I think people are sadly mistaken. I don't want to be a part of their system. And I believe Wall Street has always been the bank for the funds in order to promote their agenda, and they're using it to fit the people.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Melody Cedarstrom. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Melody Cedarstrom, certainly one of my favorite guests. And Melody, before we go on, I want you to go ahead and get your telephone number out. I want you to go ahead and get your website out there so people will know how to get in touch with you. And again, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, give us a call. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go ahead. Why don't you get your telephone number and website out there, Melody?
The telephone number is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. I believe the last time I mentioned I was working on getting my website name reduced. Well, it's still the long one. DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net. DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net. And if you'd like to email us on if you have any questions about anything, your gold and silver, your investments, you can direct them to DiscountGoldAndSilver@yahoo.com, or pick up the phone and dial 800-375-4188.
All right, fine. And, you know, I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember, but through the years, you will always find articles in the paper and say, do you realize that there's some millionaires that don't pay any taxes? Why, we've got to do something about those millionaires who aren't paying any taxes. And so they pass a whole flock of new laws. And then, of course, you know, they say, do you realize there are twice as many millionaires who aren't paying any taxes? We've just got to pass more laws, an alternative minimum tax. That's going to get those millionaires who aren't paying any taxes. And And then, of course, we find out that that hits us. That doesn't hit the billionaires. And in fact, Warren Buffett really recently admitted that his secretary, who makes $60,000 a year, doesn't pay as much taxes proportionally as he does. In other words, she pays more taxes proportionally than he does. He gets special tax breaks. Here's a man who's got $44 billion, and most of it is because he doesn't pay taxes like you and I do. They have special provisions, and they always write them into the laws, but they pass those laws in the name of, oh, we got to do something about those very wealthy people. That's how they got the income tax bill back in 1913. Oh, this was only for the corporations, the people who are making so much money. Shouldn't they simply share it with the rest of us? Well, of course, that was never the intent. The intent was that you and I, of course, would be taxed, and there would always be the loopholes for the billionaires and the multi-billionaires. And that's the way the game is played. But they never tell you that. And so next time you hear about this idea, we're going to tax the rich to help the poor, understand what they're really doing is talking about increasing your taxes. Have you noticed that, Melody?
Yes, I have. And, you know, it is with Buffett and his secretary, and they hold him up in such esteem that, you know, he is like the smartest investor ever. Well, if you have the laws and the rules and regulations passed to support what you're doing, you know, of course you can do very well. But, you know, people have certainly placed the wrong opinions on these people, and they're not going to let you win. And the whole thing is to strip you of your finances, your wealth, and your independence, and your economic freedoms, and with all the rest of the liberties that we have. And it's planned. It's been an agenda, and the only thing that is by taking control and setting and positioning yourself so that you can stand apart from them. And I hear all the time of these, you know, they got you with the 401s where you can't have access to your funds. You call and ask questions, and you know, most of them probably don't tell you the truth about the amount of funds that you can have. So always do your own investigating, too, on the programs, the different programs that you have. But I hear all the time, I know I'm going to lose all of my 401. I'm going to lose 80 to 90% of it. But yet they don't do anything to protect it. And I just don't quite understand.
Well, I think the great tragedy is, of course, if you say that you have your invest in a pension fund, and that pension fund is invested in the stock market, but what happens when the stock market falls? And I believe the stock market sooner or later is going to fall. In fact, Richard Russell, who's certainly one of the smartest people I remember almost 50 years ago when I got started. Richard Russell was an expert at that time, and he's still around. And he says, you know, that he sees the point where the price of gold and the price of the stock market are going to intercept. And I think he's talking about the price of gold going up to $700 an ounce or $800 an ounce in the stock market, falling to 800. In other words, the price of the stock market and the price of gold would intercept. And he'd made that prediction one time before, and it actually happened back about 1979. So don't completely discount this as a possibility. But if your pension fund is invested in the stock market, and, of course, the dollar tanks as we fear that it's going to, you could end up, looking at a pension fund, and you might have $1 million in it, but it wouldn't buy you a loaf of bread. Talk to the people over in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is a Rhodesia, when I lived in Africa. It was a very prosperous country, very much like ours. And, of course, it had television, it had radios, it had, it had no apartheid at all. And, of course, the American State Department was intent upon changing the structure of that society. And they did. They forced the people not to accept a man who was elected by the people, Bishop Ezekiel, but to accept a Maoist-trained communist named Mugabe. The people didn't want him, but he was forced on them by Henry Kissinger and the State Department the day why, of course, the inflation rate is 10,000% a year. You know, you get a 300% raise in your salary, it doesn't even make up for the inflation in 1 month. Certainly the whole infrastructure of the society is breaking down, and Mugabe is being fully backed by your government today. Why would we be backing a Marxist thug trained in communist China who has destroyed the value of everything the people in Zimbabwe had? Millions of people have fled the country. Most of the whites have left. But, you know, it's estimated somewhere between 3 and 4 million blacks have left the country as well, and certainly are living in camps in Zambia and Zimbabwe and in South Africa. Nobody wants them. I mean, these people are homeless. They have nothing. They're destitute, thanks to your American State Department. And if American State Department would do that to Zimbabwe after promising them that we would never allow this happen, would they do that here in America? Well, let's go to Katie, who's calling from upstate New York. Hi, Katie. How you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm fine. How are you?
Doing great. What are you around? Rochester someplace?
Actually, I'm near Utica.
Okay, fine. You're getting our evening program then. Fine. Glad to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have a question for our guest?
I do, yes. I love your program. I have lots of practical information. My question tonight about the coming like economic crash, I just moved back home. I'm living with my parents. I was making like $40,000 last year and down to a $9 an hour job right now. My question is, how can somebody like myself, who's not making very much money, don't have anything in savings, how can I prepare for, like food shortages and all that? What would be the best solution for me to prepare for economic collapse?
All right, Melody, why don't you take up that, because this is a position a lot of people find themselves in.
You're absolutely correct, and it is difficult. And, I believe you need to, if at all possible, get yourself out of debt. Work on it little at a time. Get out of that. I do believe water storage, food storage, you don't have to spend thousands of dollars of freeze-dried food and so forth. You can pick up staples of, peanut butter, oatmeal, that type of thing, rice, easily storable foods. You can, get your milk containers and, start storing water. So these are things that you can, provide for those type of needs.
How much would you recommend? Like, would you recommend like a year's worth of storage, or 2 years, or months, or
And I think that's really a personal. I believe as much as you can have, and it's affordable to you. I mean, I know people who go to the extreme, and I think it's an individual thing, supplying for your family, for yourself, and for your family.
I think that if you can get 6 months of food supply, that's great. Now, if you're really strapped, see if there's a local Mormon church. I assume you're probably not Mormon, are you?
No.
All right, fine. Well, just call the local church and ask if they have any food stores there, or you could possibly go sometime when they're canning food. A lot of these places actually have their own canneries because they look after their people, unlike the Protestant church. The Mormons have always been planning there'd be problems, and so basically before Y2K, the local Mormon cannery was gracious enough to let us take a team of people over there, and we all shared the cost. It's very inexpensive to actually can your own food, and they tell you exactly how to do it. They have the cans, they have the oxygen the containers, this is a very economical way, if they will let you do that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other thing, of course, is you can just get the items that you really, really need. Then get some silver. You may not have enough money to be buying gold, but get some silver coinage on hand, because silver will always have, the ability to purchase things. Do not get into debt. Tear up your credit cards.
Yeah, I don't have any. The only thing I have is student loans.
All right, fine. We'll try to get out from underneath those. How much do you have in student loans?
It's about $40,000, including all the interest.
Well, just do the best you can to get off underneath that, but the student loans are just such It was such a trap, and of course, many. Did you get strapped in one of these places where your university was steering you to loan companies, and they were getting a cutback on it? Because some of those were ridiculously high loans, and of course, our government was encouraging students to take out these loans, knowing full well they were being actually steered into lending companies, loan companies that were really raping the students.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I really appreciate your advice.
All right, fine. Well, just start making your preparations and begin thinking a thing through. What would you need? You're going to need some medicines on hand, and certainly you're going to need the food and water. All of these things are important, but get yourself out of debt, pay back those student loans as much as you can, and put your faith in the Lord. That's the major thing that's going to get any of us through this.
Great.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
God
Have a good evening.
God bless. That was a wonderful question, because there's so many people that don't know what to do, and I want to thank her for calling in.
And somebody had called in and asked what happened to the currency of Iraq. Well, all I can tell you is I think that the currency is pretty well destroyed there. They're using the American dollar over there as a means of exchange, but I really don't know what's happened to the Iraqi currency. Do you have any idea?
No, I really don't. You're right. I thought they were just using U.S. dollars. That was the whole point of going in there, to get Saddam out of trading his oil in euros.
Well, I suspect they've had rampant inflation. We can just tell you there's total chaos over there in Iraq, and what a terrible tragedy this whole thing is. And people say, well, wasn't Saddam a terrible guy? And he was a terrible guy. But what the American people have forgotten, he worked for the CIA in the 1950s. We brought him to power in 1979. We financed him with billions of dollars during the 1980s. We gave him the material to build the chemical and biological weapons. And if anybody doubts that, why you give us a call, we'll send you an article out of the Washington Post, of all places, that tells you exactly that, or you go up on the Internet. One of the books we carry is called See No Evil, written by a CIA agent named Robert Baer, who tells you that on two occasions the Iraqi military tried to get Saddam Hussein out of power, and in both instances the brave Iraqi military officers who wanted to get Saddam Hussein out of power were betrayed by the American State Department, and they and their families were tortured to death. Why would the American State Department during the 1990s do everything they could to keep Saddam Hussein in power? The book, entitled See No Evil, we do carry it at Radio Liberty, Nothing as It Appears to Be. Well, let's see, we have another caller here, and we'll get to them in just a minute, but before we do, let's go ahead and get your website out and your telephone number out one more time, Melody.
The telephone is 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188, and the website is discountgoldandsilvertrading.net.
All right, we've got Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, did you have a quick question for us?
Yes, indeed. The lady who just called tweaked my memory. Speaking of silver half dollars, are the banks dispensing those still, or does Melody have something that would be superior to whatever the banks might offer? I don't know if they still have the Kennedy half dollar.
No, they don't. You have to buy those through a coin dealers. What about the Kennedy half dollars? What about those that are 40% silver? What about those that are 90% silver?
Well, you have 90% silver that was they were minted up in including 1964. And then after that, from 65 to 69, they minted the 40% Kennedy halves in honor of the president for those short period of times before taking them off the market.
Mm.
So you can pick up some of those silver halves. And, you know, if you're looking for small amounts, you can always call. But you can also go into some of your local stores, and pick up some 90% silver, you know, as you have funds come available. But you can get the Kennedy halves, the Ben Franklin halves, the walking libs, the dimes, quarters. I prefer the half dollars because lots of times they disappear and premiums are created on them. So not only is it a good spending item, but you can also, it's a great little investment.
Do you have those available, Melody?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, Jack. Bye-bye. And, of course, our guest has been Melody Cedarstrom. Certainly, what you're seeing is that all throughout the world, banks and lending institutions have bought the collateralized debt obligations. These, of course, the bonds that were created, certainly by Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and actually by American corporations, with, of course, bond issues that really were not worth what they were purported. And they were given AAA ratings. They were really junk. They were sold 100 cents on the dollar. They're worth, well, a lot of them are worth 50 or 25 cents on the dollar. Financial institutions throughout the world are beginning to go under. And, of course, that's why the banks are not trusting one another anymore. Go ahead, Melody. And, Chris, one of the things I think that people have to realize is that many of the banks right now are afraid to loan. That's why they're asking sometimes instead of, you know, the 4 or 5 or 6% that we've had in the past, a lot of banks, if you want to borrow money from them, why they're asking for 8 or 9% interest on even on short-term loans and commercial paper, and because banks are afraid they're going to get stuck with loans that won't be paid back. What are your thoughts on that, and what do you think the future holds?
Well, sure, that's why lowering the Fed fund rate, you know, it's not going to do a whole lot. It might, you know, affect the psychology of everything. You have Wall Street just clamoring for lower rates, but, you know, the banks are afraid to loan, and they're charging the higher interest rates. So I don't think a quarter point's going to do a whole lot. I don't think a half point's going to do a whole lot. And I'm not even sure if they're going to lower rates. Certainly that's what Wall Street wants, but Bernanke's going to put everything into his computer, and they're all going to get together and sit around and look at the different scenarios in which, you know, we talk to customers, you know, all day long on about the different scenarios, and they'll pick one that will probably that'll affect the markets the least. So, I think people do need it. It's difficult. We have difficult times coming, and that's why I appreciate Kate calling about her question and Jack about the 90% silver. Silver is a great way. The 90% silver, the Kennedy halves, quarters, and dimes, it's a great way to pick up silver, and you're only paying, you know, 25 cents, 30 cents over spot, and that includes all your shipping charges. You know, it varies within the market. It can even be lower than that. You don't have to buy the uncirculated 90% silver, because what we buy the silver for, you know, you sort of defeat your purpose buying an uncirculated coin when it comes to the 90% silver, because you're going to pay so much more for your silver. So, you know, and lots of times those Kennedy halves, when you pull them out of a bag, because they were only in circulation for a short period of time, they look brand new. So it's very easy to pull them out of just a VG Plus bag, sign them up a little bit, and sell them off as uncirculated. So
I'm sure, you know, I'm sure some people play the game that way. Hey, our guest has been Melody Cedarstrom. Melody, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, and we'll look forward to having you back as a guest on our program here, I guess, about 2 weeks from now.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Dr. Stan.
All right. God bless. And
God bless. Good night.
All right. Fine. Well, that was Melody Cedarstrom. And, of course, again, her telephone number, 1-800-375-4188. And we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, it's not a nice thing to talk about these financial things, that we're facing a financial crisis. Nobody likes to hear bad news. People don't like to hear they have cancer. But what we have, of course, is something equally fatal for the health of our economic system. And so if you'd like to perhaps have more understanding of what's going on, we actually put together a little pamphlet. It's called The History of Money. The History of Money. It takes you back to what happened in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and Florence and Vienna and the banking systems there, and then the evolution of modern-day banking. Understand, of course, why it was that that Andrew Jackson came out against the Central Bank of the United States in 1832. And then, of course, understand how they were able to really, of course, fool the American people in 1913 and establish a central bank which has so far destroyed 96% of the value of the 1913 dollar, and they're well on the way to destroying the remaining 4%. The history of money, I think, is a good place to start, and then we have our talk called Financial Tsunami. It's available on DVD, and then, of course, it's also available. We have a syllabus that goes with it. I think the syllabus is very important, and it'll give you a lot of great information, and then, of course, we also hope that many of you will want to get the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, written by our good friend Ed Griffin, the book The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, and the little small book called Fiat Money Inflation in France. It tells what happened in France in 1789 after the French Revolution. And as you read that book, written well over 100 years ago, about something that happened over 200 years ago, it's like deja vu all over again. Because exactly the same moral breakdown and breakdown in honesty and integrity happened in the inflationary, post-revolutionary France that is going on in America, indeed, in the world today. Fiat money systems don't work. They always collapse. Also, let me suggest my last two newsletters. That's a financial a collapse, part one, part two. We're working on the financial our monetary collapse, part three, and of course, those that is my June and July newsletters. Both of them are available up on the internet by calling 1-800. I'm sorry, that's July newsletter, and August will be up there very soon. And I'm working on the September letter. But if you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, we'd be glad to send it to you. That is the Financial Meltdown, I think is the title. Financial Meltdown, and then of course we've got Financial Meltdown Part 2, which is going out very soon. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We hope that many of you actually will be making arrangements to come to our conference on the 28th of October. It's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape, a golf course on the North Shore of Monterey Bay. If you're coming from elsewhere, why, we have reserved a number of rooms there, but you're going to have to get them before the end of this month because they'll be gone. But anyway, we're going to have a great program, and we're going to be serving lunch. Going to start at 8 o'clock and go through to 5 o'clock. You'll have an opportunity to learn a lot and of course, to get a lot of your thoughts and questions clarified, so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in learning more about the October 28th conference. It's a Sunday, and we're doing that specifically because many people couldn't come on Saturdays, but I think you'll find it fascinating. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, certainly the talk on Forbidden Secrets, the secret mysteries of America's beginning, riddles in stone. Understand the spiritual nature and the spiritual forces at work. Our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. So we're going to be back here in just a moment with the next hour. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, financiers, or supporters of the station that you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our guests. And for this hour, we're going to have one of our favorite guests, Mr. William Grigg, who is formerly one of the chief editors of the New American magazine, and now, of course, an independent writer, is doing the talk radio. You want to go to his blog spot and get his material. He has a book that will be coming out very soon. But a fascinating commentator on what's going on, and I feel it's a real privilege to have him here on Sydney talking to our Radio Liberty listeners, Mr. William Grigg. Hi, William. How are you doing?
Dan, I'm doing very well. I really appreciate having me on again.
Well, we just love having you on. In fact, I get emails from a lot of our guests, a lot of our listeners, regular listeners, who always tell me who they want me to have on, and you're getting a lot of votes. So,
that's terrific.
All right. Well, tell me what the issues are you'd like to talk about, because there's so many things that are going on today that are certainly not being properly addressed by the controlled media. So what are we going to talk about to begin with?
I think of all the issues we're talking about, or that we could talk about, rather, the most important would be the nucleus around which all these other issues are sort of in loose orbit, and they would be the ongoing destruction of our economy and the concomitant emergence of unabashed imperialist foreign policies, the ruling doctrine in Washington, and how these two things are connected to each other. We have a really good juxtaposition today of what's going on with our fate as a nation in the form of Mr. Bush's speech to the nation this evening, which I think was not one of the ratings hits of the evening, because he was basically regurgitating everything he's been saying now for roughly 5 years about Iraq, about the supposed necessity for an attack on and occupation of Iraq, and the long-term strategy, which involves just staying in Iraq more or less on a permanent basis. This is the first time this evening, was the first time, to my knowledge in any case, that Mr. Bush has made it clear that his policy envisions a permanent U.S. presence in Iraq. He's talking about the idea of a troop drawdown, and that's what your prestige press is focused on. The so-called mainstream media has had headlines and lead stories on television and radio about George W. Bush announcing a troop withdrawal. But he's talking about withdrawing a portion of the enhanced number of troops that were sent there this year, as part of the so-called surge. You know, with his left hand, he sent in some tens of thousands of troops, and now with his right hand, he's taking a few thousand troops out, or he's announcing that at some date in the future, by Christmas, supposedly would see something like 5,000 troops come home from Iraq, and then sometime conveniently distant, next July, just in time for the Republican convention before the presidential election next year. He's talking about withdrawing maybe, I think it was 5 brigades from Iraq. But that's all contingent. That's all something that's in the remote and very contingent future, and that's subject to change without notice.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. We've been telling our listeners for a long period of time that we were never going to get out of Iraq.
No.
We've read the plan. It's there and on the neocon website, this organization that Sydney, the Policy for a New American Century, newamericancentury.com, and in their little pamphlet called Rebuilding America's Defenses, I believe page 14, they tell us what the plan is. Permanent occupation of Iraq. Doesn't matter, they say, whether Saddam Hussein's there or not. We're going to keep our troops permanently there, but why should we be surprised? Our troops are still in Germany,
mm-hmm.
60 years after the Second World War, in Japan 60 years after the Second World War, in Korea 15 years after the Second World War. We've conquered Iraq, we're going to stay there, but we can't tell the American people. Go right ahead.
Well, can't tell the American people in terms that are easily understood by the sort of folks who get their news from talk radio or from glancing at the headlines in USA Today, the situation with the more or less permanent deployment in Iraq, and all this, of course, is permanent in the sense that that's the intention of the people in Washington. Whether or not Washington's going to retain the wherewithal to keep those troops there is another issue. I am desperately afraid that we are going to lose an entire army in Iraq, that as our economy becomes more decrepit and the coalitions that are being formed against us become more powerful, whether in a relative or an absolute sense, I'm desperately afraid that a lot of the people who aren't blessed with the good fortune of being the first out this December or next July or whenever these rotations will occur, that sometime in the next year and a half or so, they're going to get cut off. And you would have a disaster that would compare, I think, with the loss of the Roman legions in Germany back in the 9th century of the Christian era, when Augustus, at the time, of course, he was well advanced in his megalomania and the loss of his rationality. Augustus fell to a heap on the floor, screaming, "Varus, give me back my legions." I can see that sort of thing happening here, if we're not extremely fortunate. We really have no reason to think that we will be. We have no reason to think that Providence would smile upon this venture. That being the case, I'm just terribly afraid that a lot of these people enlisted in the military and have been badly overtaxed, they and their families, been sent on repeated, very arduous deployments in Iraq, are being set up for this world historic catastrophe.
And I think you're absolutely right. In fact, there's a Lieutenant General, I believe it's Mike DeLong, and I talked to him personally this week. He's going to be a guest on our program, and of course, I'm sure he wouldn't mind my repeating it, because he's written a book now called A General Speaks Out. He, of course, was in a command position in Iraq. He's retired now, so he can tell what he believes. And he told me within this week, and we'll be telling it again on our afternoon program next week, we are going to have to get out of Iraq within a year to a year and a half, or we will lose our army. We're destroying our army. This is what the generals are saying, ladies and gentlemen. But how many people are actually hearing that? Certainly General Petraeus is not going to tell you that. After all, if he wants to keep his job, he will do what he's told to do. If anybody thinks that his testimony was an independent expression of what he really believed, has to be incredibly naive. And I believe that William is absolutely right. We are going to lose the American army, but I don't believe this is by chance. I believe there's some people who know exactly what they're doing. Well, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest, William Grieg, and I was simply telling that this week I had an opportunity to speak to a lieutenant general who is in a command position in Iraq, Lieutenant General Mike DeLong, I believe is his name, and he'll be our guest next week on one of our programs. And I asked him, what do you think about Iraq? And he said, we're going to have to get an army out of there within a year to a year and a half. We are losing our army. I mean, the people cannot stand these long deployments. I mean, we are simply, with the equipment we're losing, with the men we're losing, with the morale we're losing the American army. And please pick up the story.
Yeah, he's talking about the attrition from the op tempo here, where you've got people cycling in there for multiple tours in equipment that is in bad disrepair. And the escalation of the type of combat that grinds down armies and their material very quickly. I mean, we're talking about counterinsurgency warfare, particularly when it takes place in urban terrain, what they call military operations in urban terrain or MOUT-type scenarios. That's the sort of situation where armies go to die. And it's been that way since time immemorial. Anytime you've got an army of occupation in a hostile territory that's a relatively urban type of a setting, where the people who are fighting against the occupiers have the advantage of knowing the territory better than the occupying army. Usually you have to have a ratio between, I think it was, 8 to 10 soldiers for every insurgent in order to control the territory. You're talking about a country here the size of California. Scores of millions of people live there. It has become a magnet. This is the one thing that the Bush administration has portrayed with a certain degree of accuracy. It has become a magnet for jihadis from around the world. The Bush administration says that this is a fly trap strategy, that we're luring them there on the assumption that there is some finite quantity of jihadis and that everyone killed in Iraq represents a net subtraction from the threat we face. What they don't understand is that actually the quantity of jihadis is an expanding quantity, and that they've created a recruiting point and a training ground for jihad, and that rather than being the fly paper, what we have is a situation here where our troops are the flies that have conquered the fly paper. They're pinned down. The insurgents who are in Iraq really don't need to go anywhere. They just have to stay there in order to win. That's the sort of a circumstance that even in the best of times would result in severe attrition for a military, demoralization, and the depletion of its resources, not to mention the most irreplaceable, and I hate to use the word resource to describe it, the most irreplaceable element, which is the living, breathing human beings. But you're seeing something else happen, which is even more ominous, which is that strategy referred to, Dr. Stan, of the so-called Project for a New American Century envisions using Iraq as a staging area for other wars of supposed liberation, something that the Bush administration has obviously lusted to do for a number of years. And if you end up with a situation where you're fighting against Iran, which is a much larger country with a much better equipped military, with terrain that's much less hospitable for either occupation or for air operations, you're dealing with a situation where it would be relatively easy to see our army literally cut off and starved, or otherwise reduced to an utterly pitiable state. And when you're dealing with these type of situations, it seems to me that if you assume that the people running things in our government had the type of strategic acumen that would lead them to be relatively decent players of risk, they would have avoided making all the mistakes they're making. Suddenly, it dawns on the observer that we're not dealing with mistakes, and that stupidity can only explain so much. And as you say, I think that there is a larger design here. First of all, on the part of this power elite to have political control of the energy resources of the Middle East, it wouldn't be American control, it would be international control, in the sense that the members of the power elite from the United States have their comrades and colleagues in Europe and in Russia and so forth. And secondly, to reduce the United States in military terms, in terms of our geopolitical prestige, to such a condition that we would be a more pliant or pliable member of this international community they're always talking about. And I thought that it was interesting in that connection that Bush went out of his way in his speech tonight to talk about an enhanced role for the United Nations in Iraq. The United Nations had provided the Bush administration with the rationale for the invasion through the Security Council resolutions that Mr. Bush was oh so ardent to enforce, and he had the entire conservative talk show apparatus echoing that theme. You had people like the Synapse challenged Sean Hannity talking in 2003 about how it was vitally important that we enforce the will of the United Nations Security Council because we couldn't let that valuable institution suffer a blow to its prestige by allowing Saddam Hussein to thumb his nose at it. I used to think conservatives were opposed to the United Nations, as any rational person would be, but instead when it came to providing a rationale for war, the United Nations was suddenly valuable. And now you have the Bush administration talking about a larger role for the United Nations in terms of economic subsidies for Iraq and reconstructing its economy, reconstituting its security, and so forth. And I suspect that we're going to see a situation where, over the next couple of years, when Bush's successor settles into the Oval Office, most likely will be Madam Hillary Clinton, something that I do not look forward to, obviously, you're going to see a more overtly internationalist approach to the management of Iraq, and quite possibly to the management of what would probably be a shooting war with Iran and other conflicts in the region. And at some point, there's going to be some kind of a grand bargain struck where something is going to have to be done with respect to the financial and other obligations that the United States government has made to the UN and multilateral agencies in the UN's orbit on behalf of the United States. And that's why in my blog a couple of weeks ago I talked about the coming blood-for-debt swap, where you'd probably have some kind of a grand national service slash conscription type of an arrangement made in which American youths, both male and female, at the age of 18, would have to serve a certain term either in the military or in Homeland Security or in some kind of national service as dictated by the state. And a lot of those people would end up, I think, being sent abroad to work directly as part of United Nations peacekeeping operations or United Nations humanitarian missions or in some other capacity as conscripts working in some sense for this international coalition. That's something that's actually being discussed a little bit more openly now in the press. There was a piece in Newsweek magazine by a Marine veteran of combat roles in Iraq talking about the need, as he saw it, for conscription. There was a cover story, I believe, in Time magazine recently, or a very large feature article in Time magazine, about the need for national service. You have a Democrat presidential contender who was talking about having some kind of universal national service program. And I think that when people start talking about this as a... John McCain as well has talked about the need for national service / conscription. He's even made jokes about it and talking to some college-age crowds. So I do think that at some point, when you're hearing that many people from that many points on the respectable political spectrum talking about an idea, you're talking about a theme that's being deliberately put before the public. And I think behind this is the idea that having no more economic assets at our disposal that we can use to carry out this internationalist foreign policy, the people running it are going to be looking to our sons and daughters as a resource they're willing to put on the table. And that's the sort of thing I think that Americans really should be aware of and be ready to oppose with all their vigor, because that would be unconscionable. You're talking about a literal blood tax.
I think the people have to understand that the United States is bankrupt. We're having to borrow up to $3 billion a day just to finance this incredible bloodbath that's taking place over there in Iraq today. And now they're talking about expanding the war and going to war with Iran. And I would simply like to point out one thing I don't think most people are thinking about, and that is if we go to war with Iran and just if Iran should retaliate and against us. They had the audacity to try to defend themselves and take out a few of our aircraft carriers, or perhaps attack our troops there in the green zone. Why, of course, then we'd probably retaliate and go after their oil fields as well, and then, of course, they'll go after the Saudi oil fields and try to block the oil going out through the Straits of Hormuz. But who would benefit from that? And I'll tell you who would benefit from it: our good friends in the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what they're really doing, and actually they've even talked about how we want to shift oil production to Russia. Russia would be able then to be the primary supplier of oil to Europe and China, and natural gas to Europe and China. And, of course, they'd even become more wealthy, so they can get more in the way of weapons up there. And, of course, increasingly we see supposedly an increasingly hostile Russia, where Putin has dissolved the government over there.
Mm-hmm.
Putin is putting his military on alert, putting his planes up in the sky. Why would we do anything to help Russia? And yet, of course, that has been the policy of America since the inception of the Communist Revolution in 1917. I would like to suggest that nothing is it appears to be.
Well, the points you're making about Putin's regime are really quite provocative and timely, and it's interesting to note that just in the last couple of days, they tested what they call the Fatherall bombs, which is a huge thermobaric warhead that has the yield of a fairly sizable atomic bomb. The United States has used thermobaric warheads, the so-called MOAB, or Mother of All Bombs, in Afghanistan, and these are nominally conventional weapons that can literally uproot mountains. And Russia's thermobaric bomb, according to press accounts, is roughly five times the size, if I remember correctly, is the one that was used in the hills of Afghanistan. So there's some interesting things happening over on the Moscow side of the ledger as well. You're quite correct.
We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is William Grigg, and William's point is that we are going to keep our troops in Iraq. Everything points to the fact that we're planning out a war with Iran. How can we finance it? We're having to borrow money every single day. Are we going to continue borrowing, and what happens if nobody loans us money?
You know, the Russians used a thermobaric bomb in Grozny back in 1999, and it was in the context of this war with Chechnya, which has been pretty much the meat upon which Putin has said that he has grown so great. He was thrust into power on the basis of a number of bombings in Moscow. We've talked about this before, Dr. Stan, about the Russian bombings that were attributed to al-Qaeda. that were almost certainly, I'm almost to the point of a moral certainty convinced that they were carried out by the KGB.
Oh, that's, of course, why they killed this man.
Yeah, Litvinenko.
Yeah. Because, of course, he was a member of the KGB, and he wrote a vocal log with Yuri Belsinski. It said that the KGB blew up the apartment houses in Moscow, killing their own people, about 300 Russians, simply so they would have an excuse for going to war with Chechnya, and of course in retaliation, Viktor Litvinenko was poisoned with polonium-110,
mm-hmm.
and of course the only people who had access to that were the Soviet KGB, but pick the story up there.
Yep, and it was in 1999 that these bombings took place, and that provided the political momentum through which Putin, who was appointed to be prime minister by Yeltsin, was able to rise to the presidency and install in his retinue a number of people that are called siloviki, which means men of strength in Russian. They're people who have backgrounds in the KGB, the GRU. They're pretty much hardwired into anything of any economic value in the Russian economy, and most of these assets and infrastructure were built by the West with the help of U.S. taxpayers. You've got people running, for instance, Gazprom, which is the big state-run energy concern, which is in charge of the OPEC of natural gas. Russia is the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. And they have immense oil resources as well in the near abroad, particularly in all the stands, the Muslim former republics of the Soviet Union. And there's a lot of chicanery going on with respect to Western interests developing those resources for Russia. At the same time, it looks like Washington is trying to inveigle some of those governments into becoming closer to the NATO alliance. But it really doesn't matter whether they end up aligned with Russia and China and this new Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is sort of the anti-NATO, if you will. We used to have the Warsaw Pact. The new version of that is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or SCO, which just had joint Russian, Chinese, and Central Asian war games. Whether the Central Asian republics end up aligning with the SCO or if they end up coming into the orbit of NATO, either way, they're playing for the same team. It's a little like when you have a situation that's very common now in strip malls across the country, where you'll go to, you want to go out to have dinner at a restaurant, and you're looking at the possibility of going either to Olive Garden or Red Lobster or another restaurant. You find out that they're all owned by the same corporation. Doesn't matter where you spend your money, the same corporation is going to get a profit. Well, the same relationship obtains with respect to the power elite. It doesn't really matter whether you're wearing the colors of the SCO or the colors of NATO. If you trace back the money, power, and influence, you'll find that the same group of people is in charge of at least some of what each side of these nominal conflicts will be doing. And that's certainly true, taking the issue back to Iraq, that's certainly true with what's going on right now in Iraq, where for the first 10 or 15 years of Saddam Hussein...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grieg, and William is pointing out something very important, and that is that, of course, both sides of all of these conflicts are controlled by the same people. You will probably believe that there's a conflict between communism and capitalism. Oh, those wicked communists over there, they're threatening us. And yet, of course, if you were to read Solzhenitsyn's article, which was appeared in the Congressional Record in 1975, called the Communist-Capitalist Alliance, Solzhenitsyn points out that the capitalists have financed communism since its inception. We have a little set of four pamphlets, four newsletters called the Capitalist or Communist Capitalist Alliance. And what William is pointing out is that the same forces finance communism, they finance capitalism, they finance Saddam Hussein, they finance the people who oppose Saddam Hussein. They are certainly involved, with the Iranians. Now we're going to destroy the Iranians. But it's all a big game. The average American has very little idea that, for instance, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard was actually originally organized by the CIA to pack the Shah of Iran, and then when the Shah of Iran was deposed, why the Ayatollahs just picked up the Iranian and renamed it the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and now they're the enemy. But of course, they have a very close relationship to the CIA, and of course, in Iraq today, they have an intelligence organization. But who is funding the Iraqi intelligence organization? They're not going to get any money from the Iraqi government. Mm-hmm. Why, of course, they're getting it from the CIA. So the CIA is funding the Iraqi intelligence organization, which is, of course, the intelligence arm of the independent Iraqi government. Come on, go ahead, William.
The thing about what happened in Iraq with the rise of Saddam Hussein is that for the first 10 to 15 years or so of Saddam's career as a despot, and I think this addresses the points you just made so ably, Stan, he was actually on the payroll of both Moscow and Washington, and both Moscow and Washington knew this. And it's not as if Saddam was playing the two superpowers off against each other. He was never that canny. He had a certain, I suppose you could call it, animal guile when it came to his own survival. I mean, he was from Tikrit, which was essentially a mobbed-up town in Iraq. I mean, it was entirely in the hands of an age-old criminal syndicate. He came from that milieu, and so he had the streetwise instincts of a natural-born thug, but he didn't have the geopolitical astuteness of a Metternich. He wasn't the sort of a person who understood how to play one side off against each other. He was just on the receiving end of a lot of largesse that came to him from both Moscow and Washington. About 9 years ago, it was 1998, I did a cover story for the New American Magazine, in which I described how the weapons programs of Saddam Hussein that were built during the 1980s that included chemical warfare elements and some bacteriological warfare initiatives, how they were supplied by both the United States through the CIA and through the Department of Agriculture, which is one of the really weird things. The subsidies that were sent to Iraq from the United States went through this obscure Atlanta branch of a bank called the Banco Lavoro, and they were drawn on a program that is fairly unknown to most people. It's called the Consumer Commodity Credit, or CCC program. If you live, for instance, in Nebraska, and you're farming wheat in Nebraska or corn in Iowa or something of that sort, you'd probably be familiar with the Triple C, but other than that, you probably wouldn't have heard of it. But this is the money stream that was used to help build Saddam Hussein's domestic, or his conventional arsenal.
But that was $5 billion. In fact, eventually there was a trial held for the bank manager there, the little bank in Arkansas.
Yeah, and they gave him
$5 billion. And we still have the article in my files of the judge. And the judge said to the bank manager, "Who told you to lend the $5 billion? The bank manager said, I did it all on my own.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the judge says, "I don't believe that. Somebody obviously gave you orders to do that." And the bank manager, obviously frightened to death for the safety of his family and himself, insisted, "No, it was all my idea. I wanted to lend $5 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a small bank in, what was it, Arkansas?
Atlanta.
Yeah. Does anybody really believe that? The judge didn't believe it, and you shouldn't either. Go ahead.
Well, the thing about the other side of this stream is that while you had Iran and Iraq fighting in the 1980s, you had Moscow supplying Iran and Iraq, and the United States supplying Iraq, and then toward the end of that decade starting to supply Iran. And you had Saddam Hussein here building an arsenal that was later used to justify the attack on Iraq in 1991. And it wasn't until after the war began in 1991 that a lot of the people in the first Bush administration who were in key positions of policymaking authority recused themselves. They had conflicts of interest because they had been doing business with Baghdad.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, I guess, is William Craig. And, of course, he's simply pointing out that people in our government were doing business with Baghdad. I mean, Saddam Hussein, this wicked man, is killing people and raping women and torturing people. And he was. He was a terrible man. But we were backing him. We were financing him. And nobody ever wants to mention that, although I did hear Ron Paul the other evening in an exchange with Sean Hannity, who is, of course, bringing up all these things, and bringing up the chemical and biological weapons that Saddam Hussein had. And of course, just before he was shouted down, Ron Paul said, but we gave him the chemical and material to build the chemical and biological weapons. And then, of course, both Hannity and Coombs began talking over Ron, so nothing he said after that would get out to the public, because we can't let the American people know that, I mean, this wicked Saddam Hussein was given the wherewithal and the funding for his chemical and biological weapons from America, but he was also given them from the Soviet Union. My goodness, isn't it interesting how we often back the same tyrants?
Yeah, at the same time, Moscow was supplying him with some of the sophisticated wherewithal to conduct experiments involving bacteriological weapons and so forth. That didn't go anywhere. A bacteriological weapon, at least at that time, the state-of-the-art in bacteriological weaponry made it very problematic because there was a very strong possibility of blowback. You wouldn't be sure that you wouldn't end up infecting and destroying your own ruling elite, and so that's one of the reasons why people didn't go that direction, which is a blessing. But the thing is, as I was saying, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, way back in 1989, this is 2 years after the Iraqi attack on the USS Stark, which the Reagan administration, for some reason, blamed on Iran. The USS Stark was part of the Persian Gulf Naval Task Force, that was guarding or escorting Kuwaiti ships that were flying the U.S. flag, taking oil out of the Persian Gulf, and that was a joint U.S.-Soviet operation. There's a big clue. If you want to take a look at what's really going on in the world, you had the United States and the Soviet Navy in the Persian Gulf jointly escorting Kuwaiti oil tankers flagged with the Stars and Stripes back in 1987 when the Stark was attacked, and we lost, I believe it was 27 to 37 U.S. sailors. But it was 2 years later that the first George Bush issued a national security directive saying that it was a matter of national interest for the United States to engage in diplomatic, economic, and military contacts and cooperation with Saddam Hussein's regime. That was in 1989, and that's when the drum...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Craig. And before I let him go on, we're really talking some fascinating things, how certainly both the Soviet Union and the Russians were actually, pardon me, the Soviet Union and America were guarding, of course, Kuwaiti tankers flying the American flag, taking oil out of Kuwait. But why would the Soviet Union and America be cooperating? What you really don't understand, ladies and gentlemen, is we've always cooperated. And if you haven't read my book, A Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to, when we just go into the background of the speech given, I think it was by Senator Anderson, Senator Armstrong, a group of West Point cadets, saying, before long that was actually Lehman, who, Secretary of the Navy Lehman, said, before long you're going to be at sea looking, across 100 yards of water at some of the finest scientific technology the American Navy has ever developed. But you're going to find that it's on Soviet ships.
Exactly.
And, of course, but before we go on, William, I want you to get your website out, your blog site out, and how people can get in touch with you. And then I want to get back to this, because this is the crux of the whole issue. We have worked with the Soviet Union for years. We financed Saddam Hussein, but then so did the Soviets. But we can't let the American people know that. And today the Soviets are financing and helping the Iranians, giving them the weapons that are going to be used against American naval forces and air forces in the coming war with Iran. Why are we backing the Russians, who are backing the Iranians, who are going to be killing American boys in the coming war? Nothing, of course, really make sense. But yeah. How can people get in touch with you and get your material? Because I said the William Griggs blog site has fascinating articles on it. You want to go there every day.
Stan, I really appreciate that. The easiest way to have access to what I write is to go to The Right Source Online, which is a web portal with news and commentary. The URL for that is rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. It will take you to The Right Source. The news section of that web page is updated several times a day, and the commentaries are updated less frequently than that, but it will give you a good overview of what we consider to be the most important developments in the world with respect particularly to what's going on in the economy. And by we, I'm referring to the Welsh Foundation, which is the organization for which I work as sort of an editor at large. If you go to The Right Source Online, once again, the URL is just Right Source Online. Look at the left-hand side of the screen and then scroll down about a third of the way down the page. You'll find my photograph. And beneath my photograph, there are two hot links. And the one on the right will take you to my daily blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate. And that's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. It is updated between 4 and 6 times a week, depending upon how busy I am with other projects. For instance, I have a new book coming out entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. According to emails I got this afternoon, we've got everything done but the actual cover art. We're hopefully going to press in the next week with that book. Dr. Stan, I'll let you know when that's going to be available. It's going to cost a little less than $12. It's about a 330-page book, and that deals with what's going on in the world, particularly with respect to the issue of the Homeland Security State, the militarized, federalized, centralized law enforcement apparatus that is going to be defining our domestic concerns for a long time to come, unfortunately, unless we stop it right now. And then I've also started another book this week, and I can't give the details on that right now. It'll be a collaboration dealing with the military and the emergence of this debt for blood swap that I was describing, where the powers that be are looking with indecent lust in the direction of our children as the potential grist for their further adventures in terms of reconstituting the old Janissaries. You know, the Janissaries under the Ottoman Turks were conscripts. They were taken into the service of the imperial elite and then turned into the army of occupation on behalf of the Muslims who were ruling the Christian subjects of the empire. And we're facing sort of a similar situation right now, not in the sense necessarily that we'd be dealing with a Muslim world order, which is what's being used to frighten us, the prospect of living under an Islamic world order, which is something, admittedly, I would not like. I don't see any rational person would. But we're talking about the idea of creating a international crusader state that would be secularist and socialist in nature, and they would be the ones who would claim our children as Janissaries. And that's the subject of the new book I'm writing in collaboration with somebody whose identity I can't disclose right now. But I do keep busy.
Oh, I know you know. I don't know how you accomplish all that you do. But anyway, of course, we were talking about this close relationship that has always existed between the leaders of the Soviet Union and the leaders of the United States, whether it be Republican or Democrat. But we cannot let the American people know that, because, after all, we have to have an enemy to rally the people behind our own leaders. Let's pick up the story.
There's this sick mutual dependency. There was a term that became sort of popular 15 years ago or so in pop psychology circles. The term was codependency. They never really defined what it was. But there is this sort of sick codependency here between the elites of the West and the elites of the East, however the East is defined. Right now we're defining it increasing with respect to Islamic radicalism, and for 70-some-odd years, of course, it was defined by Soviet communist expansionism. And, of course, those two things do interact with each other. They are, in some ways, mutually inclusive. The Soviet Union did a great deal to organize and radicalize the Islamic Jihad, starting back in the early decades of the 20th century, but so did Washington. As a matter of fact, it's my opinion that Washington did more to organize the forces of Islamic radicalism than the Soviet Union did. And one of the key ways they did that was in the 1980s by lavishing weapons and money on the elements of the Afghan Mujahideen that ended up coalescing into what is now called Al-Qaeda, you know, working for the Pakistani intelligence agency as a cutout. And a really good example of a complementary tendency was what happened once again with Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was a cynical exploiter of the religious convictions of his countrymen. He was nominally a Sunni Muslim, but he was actually a Ba'ath Party socialist. The Ba'ath Party was a pan-Arabist secular national socialist movement. In that sense, it had a lot in common with sort of the militant nationalisms that started to percolate in Europe in the late 19th century. And in sort of a throwback to the 19th century concepts of nationalism. It took a while for those concepts to take root in the hinterlands of the old Ottoman Empire after World War I. And Iraq, of course, was created by Sykes and Picot by basically drawing a line in the sand and assigning a bunch of people that had nothing in common with each other to this new nation called Iraq. And out of that came the Ba'ath Party, which was a socialist nationalistic movement. And Saddam Hussein's convictions, to the extent that he had any, were all bound up in this idea of the Ba'ath Party, as well as his natural instincts as a gangster. And he cynically used religion as a way to fortify his position. But he was the perfect person to be a pawn for both Washington and Moscow, because he was brutal, he had no scruples about using force, he was somebody who just wanted to look to his own interests and those of his party, those of his ruling elite. And so he was somebody who was very instrumental right up until 1991 or 1992 or so, and it was decided that they were going to get rid of him after having cultivated him for so long. And the thing that I find really remarkable about the first Gulf War, and this is something I touched on a couple of breaks ago, was that in 1989 you had the first George Bush, first President George Bush, issue this national security directive, making it a matter of national policy to be building up Saddam Hussein's regime overtly. It had been built up covertly for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years before that, if not earlier. And then in 1991, after the missiles and bombs started to fly, you had the spectacle of people like James Baker and some of the others who were very high in power and prestige in the first Bush administration, having to recuse themselves from certain elements of the policy with respect to Iraq because they've been making money off of the Iraqi regime. Kissinger Associates, the lobbying firm put together by Henry Kissinger, one of the most detestable human beings who ever drew breath, was very deeply involved in arranging those subsidies to the Iraqi regime that we referred to by way of Chris Drogel's branch of the Bank of Lavoro in Atlanta. And Kissinger Associates gave us L. Paul Jerry Bremer, who was the first colonial overlord in Iraq after the so-called liberation in 2003. He was put in charge of the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the so-called Reconstruction Authority in Iraq. He's somebody who had helped to build Saddam Hussein's regime, and then there he was, sitting in Saddam Hussein's palaces as the proconsul running Iraq after Saddam had been removed from power. He was the one who said, ladies and gentlemen, we got him in December of 2003 after Saddam Hussein was tracked to his spider hole. And he's somebody who had been instrumental in building up that guy's arsenal. If you want a really good example of how the world really works, look at L. Paul Bremer. That's a really good example of what's going on. And the so-called reconstruction of Iraq was just this full-blown Saturnalia of corruption where you had people literally receiving shrink-wrap bricks of $100 bills from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City and then dumping money off the back of flatbed trucks to people who were the head of the radical militias that are now shooting at and killing American soldiers. And a lot of that was being done under the watch of the American general who was in charge of rebuilding Iraq's police and security forces in 2004. Under his watch, billions of dollars went missing, as well as over 190,000 small arms. And this fellow, of course, is now the military messiah du jour. It was David Petraeus who presided over a lot of this. Now, he's the guy who's going back to fix this mess. And he's the man whose word we have to accept, and whose name we must speak with reverence, lest we be accused of committing some form of lèse majeste. It's just an amazing situation here, where you have the people who are the arsonists, who are the head of the fire department shows up to put out the fires.
Yeah, but I think one of the most amazing things is when the way that media simply speaks of David Petraeus almost with reverence. I mean, he is being created for some purpose. He'll go on to, I'm sure, to Secretary of State or some other key position in government. They are investing so much time and effort in an effort to build up General Petraeus as one of the most brilliant men in the world today, sort of like Paul Bremer or Henry Kissinger, you know, these men that we should hold in reverence.
Yeah, every time you hear his name, you expect to hear trumpet flourishes and hosannas in the distance.
Right.
And it's interesting, in 2004, as you're probably aware, Dr. Stan, David Petraeus, in an unguarded moment, said that he would be interested in running for president someday, not in 2008 because the field was already too crowded in 2004, but he was looking forward perhaps to 2012 or so. And so I think they're starting to confect this hero in much the same way they did with another fellow by the name of Eisenhower, who was, mediocre military mind at best, who was a very good file clerk, but a man of no particular insight or inspirational character, who had been a lifelong Democrat in 1952, was recast as a Republican and won the presidency with not much difficulty and did that as a way of consolidating the New Deal, which was under attack at the time. You know, there are a lot of things that were really imperiled between 1948 and 1952. People wanted to return to normalcy, pre-war normalcy. They wanted to scale down government. They wanted to get us out of multilateral organizations. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, people were talking about how the United Nations seemed like a good idea because we were sick of sending our loved ones overseas to fight and kill or die or be maimed, and so the United Nations seemed like a good idea. And even somebody as supremely decent and generally insightful as Robert Taft fell for it. Senator Taft voted in favor of the United Nations Charter, ratifying that document. That was the vote that he wanted to get back desperately. But by 1948, people had become disillusioned. They saw that the United Nations was a really bad idea. The institution itself was being run by people who were in the orbit of or in the employ of the Soviet Union, and so there was a rebellion going on against the United Nations and against the New Deal and all of its works and pomps. And along came this instant savior named Eisenhower, who, as a Republican, a putatively conservative one at that, consolidated and fortified all these things, invented the spurious doctrine of executive privilege in order to prevent an obnoxious senator by the name of Joseph McCarthy from looking too carefully and into the workings of the executive branch with respect to people whose loyalties to this country were at very best suspect. And now we have David Petraeus, who's somebody who strikes me as a more competent military mind than Eisenhower in many ways, and somebody who is very much a soldier's general, in that he likes to mix up in the field with people. He likes to go on 8-mile jogs with the men. You know, there's a touch, at least for purposes of stagecraft, there's a touch of Patton in Petraeus. He's not even a patch on what Patton was as a military mind or as a commander, but in terms of the way he presents himself, he's at least learned some of the superficial aspects of how to present himself to best advantage. But he's somebody who has done more than his share to make the mess that he is now supposedly cleaning up. And I thought it was interesting how this past week there was an advertisement that was put out by this left-wing radical anti-war group called MoveOn.org, which, in spite of its provenance, occasionally stumbles into the truth about some things. And they were talking about how Petraeus was basically there as a shill for the Bush administration. He was not going to be an independent assessor. He was not going to offer an independent point of view on what was going on in Iraq. He was there basically to consummate the con game. And they played on his name in a way that was obvious but struck some people as almost blasphemous. They called him General Petraeus. And suddenly the issue this week became whether the Democratic Party would denounce Move On in its advertisement because they were speaking ill of General Petraeus. They were violating the newly minted commandment, thou shalt not take the name of Petraeus in vain.
Because, you know, I've always felt that probably MoveOn.org and all of these are basically controlled and financed by the same people who are behind the pro-war element. In other words, you have the pro-war people, the anti-war people, the pro-freedom people, the socialist people, the left, the right, the conservative, the liberal, the Republican, the Democrat, and they're all financed by the same people. It's always a controlled opposition. We saw it during Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it today. And until we understand how the game is played, well, we're going to be, taken in, by the MoveOn.group or the anti-war group. And then, of course, which side do you want, the anti-war group or the pro-war group? All controlled by the same people.
Yep.
Go right ahead.
Well, the thing about what happened with MoveOn.org, I suspect, is that they were playing a dialectical game. The idea was to make Petraeus himself the issue as opposed to the role Petraeus was playing. And the way that the multi-layered con game had been set up, how the whole objective was to put us into a position where we would have a controlled choice of options. You can choose from one of these two categories, but only these two categories.
Yeah, well, we're just about out of time here. Our guest is Ben William Grigg, and you want to go to his website, www.rightsourceonline.com. Go right ahead, William. We've got 3 minutes to wrap
up
the program.
Well, what I was saying about the two choices you were permitted and the way that you could approach this, I mean, that's the thing that the establishment excels at, is to make sure that the game of politics is played between the 40-yard lines. You can be slightly to the left or slightly to the right of what they define as the center, and beyond that, of course, you're a radical. You're part of the fever swamp retinue. With respect to what's going on in Petraeus' role in the Bush administration strategy, it's interesting to me that tonight Bush was talking about how we can join forces. Critics of the war and supporters of the war can join forces on the ground, the common ground of withdrawal through success. You know, the idea being that it will come about by succeeding. The more that we succeed in realizing his strategy, the more frequently we'll see people come home. And really, it's the same old strategy that was played out in the early 1970s, late 1960s, with the Vietnamization of the Vietnam conflict. The biggest difference being that they're not talking about getting us out of Iraq anytime in the foreseeable future. Bush presented us with a synthesis of these alternatives. You want the troops to come home? Well, this is how they're going to come home. They're going to come home only if we succeed in the strategy that Petraeus has laid out. What he didn't say was that Petraeus is laying out the same strategy Bush has been thumping on for the last year and a half or 2 years, which is just get us more deeply mired in Iraq as a way of getting us out. It makes no sense to the rational mind, but once again, you can only choose one or two of establishment-approved opinions. You can either say, well, we have to stay there and go on to Iran, or we can get out after we succeed in the strategy that Bush has laid out. But either way, you end up with a situation where we're mired in Mesopotamia for the foreseeable future, and that's just the beginning of sorrows, I'm afraid.
Well, I really agree with you, and I'm deeply concerned about the fact that I think it's only a matter of time, and I'm not talking, everything I hear suggests that you were talking a matter of months before. We're involved with the war with Iran. We're having to borrow money now to keep up the war with Iraq. Our military force is certainly facing the destruction of our American army. We're going to use up certainly most of our ordnance, our bombs, our missiles, our rockets. They're all going to be expended, our cruise missiles. They're all going to be expended there. And then where are we going to get the money to rearm? Or maybe we're not going to need it. Maybe we're going to have a world government and a world army, and so we will not need America as the policeman of the world. William, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure, always insightful. I know our listeners all around the world appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's always a blessing to be with you.
Good night. God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we really are privileged to have William Grigg as one of our regular speakers here. And we do hope that many of you out there across America, certainly if you'd like to get the full talk, because we do talk through the breaks, why the audio tapes are available, and very often William is one of our Tape of the Month Club selections, and so if you would like to seriously consider joining the Tape of the Month Club, you can either get the four best CDs or four best tapes of the month, along with our newsletter, and you join the Radio Liberty family, and you help us. And then, of course, you can get the tapes independently, if you'd like, or the CDs independently. If you'd like, of course, to really understand what this is all about, we carry several excellent books. One is See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent. Another is The Devil's Game. It goes into the background of how the United States and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan created Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. We have a set of pamphlets. They're called Foreknowledge 911. You can go to my website at RadioLiberty.com and pull down my newsletters August through December of last year, of 2006, and they'll give you much more additional information, information you need to understand what is really going on today. Then, of course, to understand the spiritual component which motivates the people behind things, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, is vitally important. My talk, Forbidden Knowledge. We recommend them both. And there's a syllabus with the title is Forbidden Secret. We do hope you'll want to get that. You certainly want to get the videos on the secret mystery of America's beginning. Riddles in Stone. And that we've got some great new four tape sets. The North American Community, The Demise of National Sovereignty, and if you get that along with the book, The Late Great USA by Dr. Jerome Corsi, there's a special on that. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the impending police state. It goes into the plan for concentration camps. It goes into the Military Commission Act and the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act and so many of the other things that are coming down the line. We have a four-tape set on globalism, the secret threat. We have a new four-tape set on, it's called The Secret History of the United States. The Secret History of the Empire of the United States. And of course that goes along with the book, The Secret History of the American Empire. And, of course, we also carry the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman, a man who was employed by the government to ensure the fact that people in third world nations never had a chance to get out of poverty. So The Secret History of the American Empire and, of course, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, both by John Perkins. We have a four-tape set on The Economic Hitman, the new four-tape set, The Secret History of the American Empire, all available from Radio Liberty. You need to get the information. You need to help us get it out across America while there's still time. We want to remind you about the all-day conference on the 28th of October, a little over 6 weeks from now. And, of course, it's going to be held at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. If you're going to come, going to have reservations. We're serving lunch starting early in the morning, going until late in the afternoon. Great lineup of speakers here. And so that's the 28th of October, and we hope you'll tell others. You'll get them to come. Tell the people about our programs. Encourage them to start listening. Nothing that you're getting from the regular media is going to explain what's really going on, because we're truly involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield, a battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty. Our number, 1-800-544-8927.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.